Matthew chapter 24, verse number 36, down through verse number 38 and 39 says, "But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days that were before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered into the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." The Scripture before us tonight indicates the sudden calamity that can come into a life in a matter of moments, unsuspected, unrealized until its very last moments are upon us. I mentioned this morning that I would like to preach to you tonight a message that I've preached for a number of years now, being this is the anniversary of the event that would have occurred in just a few hours' time from now, somewhere in the North Atlantic, actually 41 miles, 46 degrees north latitude, 50 miles, 14 degrees west longitude. At approximately 12:40 in the evening of April the 14th, 1912, the British ship Titanic hit an iceberg and sank in less than 3 hours' time. It became known as one of the greatest disasters of maritime history. The most luxurious ship of its day, the safest of all luxury liners crossing any ocean in the world. Took less than 3 hours to go to the bottom of the ocean. The call had come somewhere around 12:40 that evening. It had been ignored on the bridge of Titanic. It had come again and had been ignored on the bridge of Titanic. And finally, the third call was answered. First Officer Murdoch was in charge of the ship. Captain Smith had taken a stroll around the deck and was no longer on the bridge. And when First Officer Murdoch picked up the handset, he received word from lookouts who, strangely enough, on board the first-class ship of its day, had no binoculars. And he was told that there was an iceberg dead ahead in the path of Titanic. Titanic was then traveling at nearly 26 miles per hour, which was very close to her top speed. And the gigantic of a ship that she was, 26 miles an hour, would be somewhat similar to flying on a 747 at about 700 miles an hour in the situation she found herself. Murdoch was not a novice. He was an experienced seaman, like Smith, who was captain. Murdoch first ordered all engines stop, then he ordered all engines full reverse. At the same time, he ordered steering hard to starboard in a hope that with those actions, the result would have been to have pulled the ship to the port side, causing it to miss the iceberg. His response was correct, and the orders were executed promptly. But it was too little and too late, because the ship passed with a glancing blow off the side of a gigantic iceberg. For years, any of the accounts that you read, I have a 1914 account that I've read several times, and their consensus was that along the waterline, the iceberg had buckled plates and popped rivets and virtually destroyed the entire side of the ship, in order to explain the speed with which she sank. Recent deep submersible investigation has revealed that in reality it was not a rip or a tear or a puncture or a broken bulkhead. It was a series of little pinprick holes that were punched along the side of that great ship. We did not understand in 1912, and we sure don't understand all today, but there's a thing called blue ice. Blue ice is formed by the repeated thawing and refreezing of glacial ice. And sometimes that ice has thawed and been refrozen as many as 1,000 times. And each time it makes it a little bit stronger. Some have estimated that some blue eyes could rival the strength of titanium because it is so hard. And it is recognized that that iceberg, more than likely, was one that had broken off of a shelf of ice, northerly in the glacier ice off of Greenland and Newfoundland in that area, and had drifted south and probably just as blue of ice as you could find, and it simply raked itself down the side of that giant ship and stabbed little ice pick-sized holes all along the side of that ship. One of the submersible teams estimated that if you took all of those little holes and put them all together and made a gaping hole out of it, that that hole would be less than the size or the volume of a man's body. That's all the size that the hole was. And yet it put the giant ship on the bottom of the ocean in less than 3 hours' time. Estimates say that there were somewhere between 2,206 and 2,340 passengers on board the Titanic. You say, why the discrepancy? Depends on who you read and when they wrote. I think some of the first accounts probably were a little bit sketchy. And there were a number of people that did not make the voyage who were intending to be on the voyage. But nonetheless, somewhere in that number were on board. And on board also were 20 lifeboats. 20 lifeboats that had a capacity of between 58 and 60 passengers each. Which meant that there was enough room for 1,100 people to have escaped the Titanic in its situation. Remember, there were 2,200 to 2,300 on board and room in the lifeboats for only 1,100. Most of the reports were sketchy as the emergency signals began to be sent. Captain Smith ordered them immediately to begin sending and broadcasting CDQ. CDQ was the accepted distress signal of the day. The problem with the CDQ distress signal was that CDQ was an ambiguous term. It could mean ship sinking, or it could simply mean get off the air, there's too much talk on the air. It was a way of clearing the channel. And shortly after CDQ had been sent by the Titanic, their response was changed, and for the first time ever, a ship in distress began to broadcast SOS, which stood for Save Our Ship, or Save Our Souls, because they knew they were going to the bottom. The ship's signals were sent out. Its signal flares were launched until all of them were gone. Its crew, in a brave and valiant effort, stayed at their post, some say, until the moment that the ship slipped beneath the water, somewhere around 2:40 in the morning. Of the 2,200 to 2,300 people on board, originally, the newspapers said the next morning that the Titanic had struck an iceberg but was proceeding to New York unmolested. Some of the accounts said that although the ship had hit an iceberg, the crew and the passengers had been safely transferred and none had been lost. There would be a United States Senate investigation, not only of the sinking but of the way in which the reporters handled the incident. People's hopes raised and then dashed and then raised and then dashed again as reports came in and then were countermanded by other reports following. The truth of the matter was, when the tally was given of the 2,300 people on board, 705 survived, which means that 1,500 or better people lost their lives in the North Atlantic on the night of April the 14th. In the year of the Lord, 1912. You say, why would you use that historical event? I would use that historical event because of what the text says tonight. It says that the people who perished in the day of Noah knew not until the flood came and took them all away. I believe as a Christian we live in a world that is ignorant of its own destiny. We live in a world amidst people who are insensitive to their own soul's lost condition. The devil has seen to it that they have every comfort and every pleasure available to keep their mind off of the disaster that is unfolding. And it is oftentimes not until the disaster has come, has gone, and has given us its tally that we realize what a great disaster it really is. The Bible said that the road to heaven is the straight gate and the narrow way that leads to life everlasting. And then the Lord said that broad is the way and wide is the gate that leads to destruction, and many there be that go thereat. I believe tonight in our world, if you'll be honest as a Christian, there are more people on their way to hell tonight than there are to heaven. Somehow you think of that, and as an American, you probably have a hard grasp of that, but I remind you on the night of April the 14th, about this time, in the middle of the North Atlantic, there were a number of people having the time of their life, and they did not know until the flood came and took them all away. The sinking of the Titanic became known as a tragedy. I was in Halifax, Nova Scotia, a year or so ago, and while I was there, I visited the graveyard where they brought many of those bodies found floating in the Atlantic as the Carpathia sailed and steamed in to the area of disaster the next morning around 4 to 6 a.m., began picking up bodies. Those bodies were taken then to Halifax, Nova Scotia, where they were interred in two cemeteries. It is a tragic sight to behold, to realize that just a few hours before they met their fate, these people were singing and dancing, eating and making merry. I saw while I was there the one piece that survived the sinking of the Titanic intact. Everything else that was picked up as debris on top of the water was broken and twisted and marred. But the one piece that survived was a wooden deck chair, which people had used to set in to gather some sun. Only one survived. Everything else was crushed and broken and destroyed. That great ship went to the bottom of the ocean, taking with it nearly 1,500 lives in a matter of 3 hours. The passage before us says they knew not till the flood came and took them all away. Psalm 108 verse 12 says, "Give us help from trouble, for vain is the help of man." I'd like to recount for you tonight, if I might, not one tragedy, but three tragedies that made this such a long-lasting memorial to faithful voyages. The first tragedy is the tragedy of a misplaced trust. A misplaced trust. If you consider the passenger list of HMS Titanic, it is a veritable who's who of the day and times in which those folks were living. Anybody who was anybody was on board or near or standing on the dock mourning the fact that they couldn't get on board the Titanic when she left for her maiden voyage. 1912, if you'll understand, was a time when we had begun to reach what we believed was a pinnacle as far as our technological advancements had occurred. We had harnessed electricity. We had harnessed the power of steam. We had electric lights. And all of those things were now making their appearance in the homes of Americans and Europeans. Not only that, but we've become a much safer people. When people become comfortable, they worry about their safety. And as they begin to worry about their safety, industry had become a much safer place to be involved in as a vocation. Shipbuilding was one of the remarkable things that had shown great improvement in the years. Every safety feature that could be imagined had been incorporated into the shipbuilding techniques of those days. And the ships coming out of and sailing the ocean were some cases 1,000 times safer than those other vessels that were made years before, because so many advances had been made. Oftentimes people question why Titanic had only 20 lifeboats, but the problem is not recognizing the fact that Titanic had been deemed a lifeboat itself. The need for lifeboats on lifeboats has rarely been heeded. The people of the day, the engineers, the construction people, the designers and the owners all felt that Titanic was the safest vessel of transportation in the world. The newspapers and even some of the owners had made the statement that not even God Himself could sink the Titanic. One has said, they bragged and said it would never sink, and the only thing that it did was sink. a misplaced trust. You see, people of this time were so excited about the technological advances. They were so excited about how mankind seemed to be bettering and seemed to be pulling himself up by his bootstraps. He was a more educated, he was a more civil individual, and he seemed to be making great progress in the direction of world peace and contentment. And there were those who put their trust in that belief system. Some on board the Titanic were worth literally millions and millions of dollars. Probably the most well-known was John Jacob Astor. John Jacob Astor was by far and away at that time, if not the, then certainly within the top two of the richest men in existence. His fortune was somewhere in the realm of $150 million. Now remember, this is in 1912. When you could buy a brand new Cadillac for $975. You can do the math yourself. John Jacob Astor was wealthy by far and away of all of those of his contemporaries. He was so wealthy that he had time to lavish himself with the luxuries of his day, one of which was immorality. He had just come from Egypt where he had married a teenage fiancée who was pregnant with his child. He had stopped back in England just so he could ride home on the Titanic, knowing that it would be one of those things that you'd want to be able to tell people about. I was on board the Titanic. His body was brought home. His bride survived. He did not. Another on board was Benjamin Guggenheim of the American Smelting and Refining Company, worth by those days' dollars over $50 million. Major Archibald Butt was on board. He was the personal military advisor to President Taft and was returning from official state business in Europe. Isidore Strauss, a clothing merchant. Many of you still have some clothes with his name affixed to them. Was on board. His estimated worth was $95 million. On board also was J.J. Ismay, who was the owner of the International Mercantile Marine Company, the builders of HMS Titanic. It is said that one of the passengers on board the Titanic had one string of pearls that was valued at over $250,000. $1912. Estimated cost today would be 5 to 6 times that amount. It was a who's who list of people. Everybody wanted to be on board. It was the thing to do for, I guess we could call them jet setters, but since there were no jets then, maybe we would just call them ocean going voyagers. But it was the place to be. And they had flocked and bartered and paid extravagant prices to be on board HMS Titanic. The best suites on board Titanic were taken for a mere paltry $4,300 United States 1912 money. I don't know if you've taken a cruise lately, but $4,300 will buy you the finest stateroom on virtually any ship you can go on a cruise on. Even to this day, $4,300 for a suite. Folks were paying $2,300 for a smaller suite that had its own balcony or promenade. $2,300 U.S. 1912. Again, 5 or 6 times that today. And yet they paid it and paid it gladly. First class was overbooked. There were too many that wanted to book. As a matter of fact, the ship was full from top to bottom. It was full of first class, second class, and even steerage passengers. Everyone wanted to be on board the Titanic. Everyone wanted to make the maiden voyage on the greatest ship that existed. It would be somewhere in the realm of being able to fly on the space shuttle. The greatest technological advance of its day. They put their trust in that great ship. They paid a price, but it was a trust placed in nothing more than steel and iron. And there was a lot of it. Titanic was 882 feet long. It was a huge ship even by today's standards. Its anchors weighed 15.5 tons each. One link in the anchor chain weighed 175 pounds. She had three props that pushed her through the water. The center prop weighed 22 tons. The two side props weighed 38 tons apiece. And they would push her through the water at a top speed of somewhere between 25 and 28 miles an hour, which for a vessel that size in the water at that time was a speedboat. It took 12,000 tons of rivets to hold her together. 12,000 tons of rivets to hold her plates in place. She had a double bottom that was anywhere between 5 and 6 foot thick, depending on where on the ship you would chance to look. She was a veritable, unsinkable ship. She had 16 watertight compartments designed specifically, controlled with doors that could be opened and closed either electrically or manually, making each of those compartments watertight. It was said that she could have survived the direct collision with the iceberg probably better than the glancing blow that she took. Because had damage only been done to the front of the ship, had the front of the ship filled with water, she would have remained afloat much longer than the 3 hours that she survived. Each of the doors was designed to close with a button pushed on the bridge. And if that button was not pushed, then any crewman knew how to work the manual control levers. It was said that she could survive with at least 3, possibly as many as 5 of those watertight compartments completely flooded. And yet she went to the bottom in 3 hours, taking 1,500 people with her. She was a luxurious ship, to say the least. The Titanic was complete with tennis courts, ballrooms, a gymnasium, and even an elevator, of which there were less than the number you could count on both hands in service in Europe in buildings. But Titanic had one. She had virtually everything you could desire. She had separate cold storage for meat, vegetables, and even a cold storage locker for wine, all by itself, controlled with its own refrigeration unit. She had everything necessary to make the voyage the most wonderful in the world, but she only had 20 lifeboats. Misplaced trust. What do you mean? I mean people trusted in that ship to get them from one point to another. They put all their confidence, as I preached this morning, in a vessel made of steel and iron, thinking that not even God Himself could sink her. I found it ironic that one of the last two songs, again, depending on who you read, for years I heard people that placed the disclaimer to those who had said that the last song played on board Titanic was "Nearer, My God, to Thee." They scoffed and ridiculed the religious people who said that, and now they've admitted that it was probably the second to the last song played on board the Titanic. They would have had you believe that there was nothing but a gay spirit of enjoyment on board the Titanic when she went beneath the waves. But I wonder how many of those people that said that not even God Himself could sink this great ship listened while the orchestra musicians played "Nearer, My God, to Thee." You know, there are a lot of people in this world that put their trust in things that will fail. They look at luxury, they look at fine things, they look at wonderful things, they look at comfortable things, they look at convenient things, and they enjoy all of those things, and they will put their confidence and their trust in those things. But those things will fail every time. If you had, at exactly this moment, on board Titanic, April the 14th, 1912, strolled up to any passenger walking on that deck as the sun was setting, and ask them, do you believe you'll be dead before the night's over? They'd have laughed you off the ship. They had put their utmost confidence in the thing that they were riding on and living upon. Much like the world in which we live, places their trust, places their faith, places their confidence in a religion, in a religious way, in a religious ritual, in a religious system that will do nothing more than fail them. Our world has been in the midst of a scandal in the last several weeks as the greatest of Christian denominations, and I use that term very loosely, there's nothing Christian about it. The greatest of Christian denominations has been found to be nothing more than a harbor for perverts in many, many cases. You say, what's going on? I've watched the news accounts and I've seen some as they bit their lip literally and said, well, it doesn't matter. I'm going to stand with the church. You could have stood on board the Titanic too, but it really wouldn't matter where you put your faith and trust. You had it in the wrong thing. They put their faith, they put their trust, they hope against hope in various inventions of man, be it religious or otherwise, to get them home to heaven. But the truth of the matter is, it simply won't work. Someone has said, as long as we are sincere, that is what matters, and we are moving toward a better place, and we're all trying to get to heaven, and all roads lead to the same place, and all religions lead to the same place. That is nothing more of an indicator that you've placed your trust in the wrong things. All religions don't lead to the same place. They don't all point to the same place, and sincerity will get you nothing. If someone sincerely believes the light is green when they run the red light, they will be just as dead when the car hits them broadside as the one who intentionally set out to cheat the red light. You see, sincerity doesn't matter when it comes to a tragic mistake. It is a tragic mistake no matter what you believe. I find in Luke chapter 15, the Bible said that the rich man died and in hell he lifted up his eyes. I take from reading that passage that it was somewhat of a surprise to him that he was there. I don't believe he intended. As a matter of fact, I know he didn't intend to be there. If he did, he would have made other arrangements. It was a shock. It was a surprise. I don't know what he had put his trust in. I don't know what he had put his faith in. But I know wherever he had put his faith and his trust, it had been misplaced because as certainly as he lived and died, he now was in hell burning forever. And as surely as folks on board the decks of the Titanic at this time, many, many years ago, strolled the deck arm in arm, enjoying that last little wisp of sunshine, as sincerely as they believed that the ship would get them safe to New York, as much as they had invested of their money to be on board, and as many newspaper accounts as they had read, which reaffirmed the fact that not even God Himself could sink her. In a matter of hours, she was going to the bottom, and she would most likely take them with her. A misplaced trust. Be sure not to put your faith in the wrong thing. Be sure not to put your faith. How many times have we read the articles where one said, I thought the gun was not loaded? One who said, I thought that we could get the fire out. One who said, I thought we could. I thought. Behold, I thought. There were a number of thinking people on board the Titanic. The tragedy was that they thought the wrong thing. And they put their trust in a place where they should not have put it. The tragedy of a misplaced trust. The second tragedy of that night was a tragedy of an unheeded warning and call to action. I said before that the bridge of Titanic had been notified twice before. Attempts had been made to call the bridge. They had seen the iceberg and made a phone call and no one answered. They had watched the iceberg grow closer and closer. And again, they had no binoculars. They had watched it as it grew to a mammoth in size, and they had tried to call the bridge again, and the call went unanswered. And then finally, on the third attempt, someone picked up the phone. Too late. Too late. Sad, but too late. By all accounts, Titanic had been radioed on at least four different occasions the day prior that there was a massive field of ice directly in her path. Not an iceberg. Not several icebergs. But a massive field of ice is the way the radio transmission had been written. As a matter of fact, by some accounts of the crew, the navigators on board had plotted the course and they had estimated that they would arrive at the fringe of the ice pack at 11 o'clock that evening. Less than an hour later, she was in jeopardy because they simply chose not to pay attention. Rather than decreasing speed, rather than even slowing and just floating until morning, when visibility would be much improved, they decided to charge ahead into what they knew was treacherous water. And not just to move ahead, but to race at nearly full speed. They did not heed the warnings. When the ship struck the iceberg, it struck it with such a violent jolt that ice fell from the berg all over the deck of Titanic. And yet that jolt barely woke passengers asleep in their compartments. Such a huge ship. As soon as the damage had been surveyed in just a matter of minutes, it was determined that the ship, although everything that had been said about it was said in honesty and in integrity, they knew the ship was going to sink. Crew was ordered by the captain to assemble the passengers with life vests. They went from ballroom to ballroom, to the gymnasium. They went to all the places where people would haunt at late night hours enjoying themselves. And then they began to go from cabin to cabin, banging on the doors and yelling down passageways, encouraging the passengers that the captain had ordered all passengers on deck, all passengers in life vests. By the accounts of the crew and even some of the surviving passengers, most people thought it was a joke. Some were even so brash as to come on deck, collect several pieces of the ice as a souvenir, and ask one of the stewards if they would take it back down to the refrigerator compartment so they could have it when they got to New York. Many, many refused to put on a life vest. There was a grand ball going on in one of the ballrooms. It is said that most all of the women refused to put on a life vest for fear that it would crumple their evening dresses. It is said there was no need. Titanic, after all, could not sink. It would not sink. When orders came for passengers to be put on lifeboats and for the ship to be abandoned, although there were 20, there was room on 20 lifeboats for 1,100 people. You can do the math. 400 people refused to get on board that could have gotten on board. 400 people refused to climb into a cold, drafty old lifeboat, thinking that at worst this was no more than a drill, put on for the watchful eyes of some inspector. And while people flitted around the deck, refusing to be rescued down below, engineers and firemen struggled to keep the boilers moving and lit so they could supply electricity because the ship was in danger of going completely dark. And yet they waltzed around the decks with no concern whatsoever. A group of gamblers came out on deck, smoked a cigar, and then went back to their gambling. Some stayed in bed telling the steward that he was crazy because Titanic could not sink. Some laughed when they were told and ordered to get into the boat that they would not go because they would just be back in a few moments and they didn't want to get their feet or clothes wet. And so some of those first lifeboats that pulled away from Titanic with a capacity of nearly 60 had only 10 or 11 passengers. An unheeded warning. Although there were not enough lifeboats on board for everyone, think of the greater tragedy that the lifeboats that were on board were not utilized. When Carpathia would arrive on the scene early the next morning, she would begin to collect lifeboats. And the crew and the passengers of Carpathia were astonished at why so few lifeboats had capacity crowds. What happened? Why did nobody get on board? And the response was always the same. They didn't care to. They didn't believe they were in jeopardy. I wonder tonight how many lost sinners across this land have sat somewhere today in a church where a preacher has stood and warned of the coming disaster. He's cried again and again and again, "You must be born again." And yet they have flitted around in life, not concerned about their own destiny. Not concerned enough to get in the lifeboat. Oh, they would tell you right now, if their life was in danger, they'd be the first ones to trust Christ as their Savior. But after all, they were young. They were healthy. They had a long life ahead of them. Just like people on board Titanic did not need life preservers. The tragedy of a misplaced trust. The tragedy of an unheeded warning and call to action. And then finally, the tragedy of unsent help. The tragedy of unsent help. Some of the ironies of the ship are in the fact that there were nearly, I believe, if I can remember correctly, over 200, closer to 300 engineers on board. Engineers who had been involved in the construction and the design, who had come along to make sure that every part, every system was functioning as it should. Titanic had an abundance of engineers who could have fixed anything except what they encountered. They worked side by side with the firemen who stoked the boilers to keep the major fires running and all of the boilers that powered all of the equipment on board the ship. And yet when the toll was counted, although there were a number of firemen that survived, there was not one engineer among the survivors. A tribute to nobility. It says it's better to die trying to save someone's life than it is to save your own. Not one engineer got off of the ship. They all went to the bottom trying to keep the fires burning. What an indictment of Christians who live in a world where people are dying and yet refuse to spend a nickel to help a church or to send a missionary. Who refuse to be faithful at keeping the fires burning. Who refuse to be involved in stoking the furnaces. Who refuse to take seriously the need of duty in their lives. Oh, if this is America, the great ship that's going down, I would say there'll be a lot of Christians that will survive. Because they'll desert their posts and save themselves. One of the most notorious of those rescued was J.J. Ismay, the one who owned the company that had constructed the Titanic. There were tales of gallantry. Major Archibald Butt, I believe, was awarded a medal posthumously for his action on board the Titanic that night. John Jacob Astor, it is said, exhibited some of the greatest bravery seen on board the ship that night as they struggled to keep those last few boats from being sunk with the people that finally began to realize that that was their last hope. And several hundreds wanted to get on each boat. There were calls for gallantry and there were those who lived up to it. But Ismay was remembered because he somehow was on a lifeboat. He made excuses as to his place there. When questioned why the grand designer and owner of the company that had built, the man who probably knew more about the ship than even her captain, why he was on a lifeboat, he never could give a satisfactory answer. Some even made accusations that he had donned women's clothes in order to get on board and save his own life. He lived the rest of his life in obscurity and shame. But there was assistance that could have been given. Carpathia was the first ship or the closest ship to respond to the call for help. Carpathia was a luxury liner and was actually steaming away from Titanic towards the European continent. They had passed already. And Carpathia was sailing with its complement of crew and passengers on a luxury holiday, just the same as those on the Titanic, although not quite so extravagant. The call came that Titanic was in distress. The captain immediately ordered to reverse course and to steam full speed to come to the assistance of Titanic. It is said that when the story was told among the passengers who had paid fares, not one of them balked at his decision. They must go back and help Titanic. She was 58 miles away, and at her speed, it would be a little after 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning before she reached the scene. When she arrived, the best that Carpathia could do was to pull in tow, and then rescue those passengers who were in lifeboats. 6 of those who had gotten into lifeboats actually perished because of injuries they had received either en route or because of the cold chill of the night and their lack of clothing. Most people were in their night clothes. But the tragedy was not in Carpathia. Carpathia sailed into New York and sailed right past its mooring, where a huge conglomeration of reporters waited for that story. And Carpathia sailed right past its own moorings and sailed upriver just a bit further to the moorings for the White Star Fleet, to the place where Titanic should have been moored. And there she unloaded lifeboats. The lifeboats that had remained were set in a row along the dock where Titanic should have moored. And then she returned to her docking. The tragedy was not in Carpathia. She rescued every one that she could. The tragedy was in another ship called the United States USS California. One of the greatest pieces of dissension in the Senate hearings was in the role of the USS California. Interviews with the crew and even the bridge complement affirmed the fact that she was within visual sighting range of Titanic at the time she struck the iceberg. California, with perhaps much greater discretion and wisdom, had slowed her speed to navigate the icebergs. And as a result, she had lost her lead on Titanic. Although they were not in a race, she was certainly further ahead. And as Titanic steamed full speed into a field of ice, California had given up much of her speed and actually decided to just wait it out until she could navigate in the morning light. Crew that were interviewed were asked, "Did you not see the Titanic? Could you not tell that she was sinking?" The crewman responded, "Yes, we saw the lights and we knew it was Titanic. There was no other ship like that." But as Titanic was sinking, the lights would disappear as deck by deck went underwater, which is the same result of a ship sailing away over the horizon as it sinks not in the water, but over the arc of the earth. And we assumed that Titanic was simply steaming away from us. We did not know she was sinking. Another question was, did you not see the distress flares? Oh yes, we saw the distress flares. But Titanic was known for its robust frivolity, and we thought it was simply a display of fireworks for the enjoyment of her passengers. Oh yes, we saw the emergency flares, but we did not know she was sinking. And finally it was asked, did you not hear the call for help over the wireless? Did you not hear the CDQ and the SOS that were issued? And one said it was a slow night. We were tired. And the captain had ordered that the wireless be turned off. We went to bed. By some reports, California was close enough to have heard the cries of the people who would perish in the water that night. At nearly 2:40 in the morning, last accounts state that Titanic was now almost perpendicular in the water when she broke in half and went to the bottom, carrying most of her crew and passengers with her. Those who had the misfortune to survive the sinking were left in the water. They did not drown. They froze to death, floating in the icy waters of the North Atlantic ice field. When Carpathia steamed in the next morning and finished collecting the survivors, she began to collect bodies. And the accounts told of some of the grisly and gruesome appearances of those bodies, clinging to bits and pieces of debris, one mother clinging to a frozen baby. Gone. Hundreds of them. As far as the eye could see across an ice field, debris and bodies. Those who had put their life preservers on still floated, but they were frozen. They had perished. I saw a picture of a New York newspaper that was the one that actually brought the tragic news to the people of New York. Was in the Maritime Museum in Halifax. And it said this, listed below are the passengers of Titanic. And below that were two columns. At the top of one was the word saved. On top of the other was the word lost. And I thought, my soul, we're in a situation dealing with the saved and the lost. We're in a situation dealing with people who are perishing. Did you ever notice how many of our hymns are written on a seafaring theme? Did you ever wonder about that? Rescue the perishing, care for the dying, throw out the lifeline, ship ahoy, we have an anchor. Let the lower lights be burning, the haven of rest my anchor holds, Jesus, Savior, pilot me. Hundreds of our songs and hymns have been written with a maritime theme. You say, why? Anyone who's ever sailed the seas can tell you. It's the worst way to die
that can be imagined, alone in the icy waters, to perish. Christians in a day gone by recognized that they were there as those to rescue those who were drowning. There were not that many to lend assistance the night the Titanic went to the bottom. And the ones that could have perhaps saved all of those floating in the water that night never responded. Hundreds more people who floated in those icy waters and screamed for help and then cried. And then the cry became simply a whimper. And then there was stillness. While the great ship California, close enough to see what was going on, stayed at rest and did nothing. There are so many Christians in this day and time who sit by idly with friends and neighbors and families and co-workers who are perishing. And they say and do nothing. What a great responsibility we bear. Years ago, another shipwreck in Lake Michigan would claim the lives of hundreds of people on board a ferry boat that simply hauled passengers. It had capsized several hundred yards from the shore. On a stormy day, windy, icy, blustery. People lined the shore and watched as people clinging again to debris begged for someone to lend assistance. And on the shore that morning was a young man who was training for the United States Olympic swim team. He dove into the water and swam out through that cold water, grabbed hold of one and brought them back to shore. And then he turned and swam and brought another. And then another. And then another. And as long as his body would give him energy, he returned and swam back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Until finally he collapsed on a beach. And even then tried to crawl his way back into the water. And as they stopped him and they said, "You can do no more," he continued to repeat the question, "Have I done my best? Have I done my best? Have I done my best?" He would never swim in the Olympics. His body was destroyed from the stress of his life-saving involvement. But another who heard that story picked up a pen and sat down at a desk and wrote a hymn that said, "I wonder, have I done my best for Jesus who gave Himself for me?" And I wonder tonight, Christian, not too many hours from now, many years ago, the joy and the happiness and the frivolity on the greatest ocean-going vessel, perhaps of all time, would turn to terror and screams and pleas for help. I think if you listen in the day in which we live, you can hear those all around us. Although their face might not tell the tale, you and I know they're on board a ship going down. You and I know that their names will be listed among the lost in heaven's annals. And you and I know that we have the means to rescue the perishing. And I wonder tonight, Christian, Are you doing your best?
Are you willing to sacrifice even your future to see one brought safe to shore? To see one rescued who will never endure the flames of an everlasting hell? To see one brought to safety?
I wonder, have I done my best? Think of how many of those 1,500 men and women, boys and girls, babies, 5-year-old boys, 7-year-old girls, mothers clinging to 2 and 3 children, knowing they could not even save themselves. I have a list of the survivors. I think that there may have been one family that survived intact. For every survivor, there was a memory of a loved one who did not. For every mother, it was the memory of a child or a son or a husband who had no seat on the lifeboat. And so she lived with that all of her life. And I remind you tonight, as you search your memories, you think back to the day you were on board the ship that was going down. You think back to the day when you put your trust in everything but Jesus Christ. And then remember the joy that flooded your soul when you knew that you were saved. When you knew that you were redeemed, when you knew that you would not perish. But remember those who are still on board, who will perish if no one does nothing. And tonight I ask you, if you're here and you're not a Christian, to take your trust, to take your faith, and to remove it from the things of this life. To take it off of your money or your morality or your religion or your ritual, and to put it on Jesus Christ alone. This world is sinking. And if you're here tonight and you're a Christian and you would with me rejoice in the fact that you've been saved, I say look around. The lifeboat still has some empty seats. There's still room for a good complement in this vessel. Let's turn again and row into the dangerous waters. It is said that the thing that most of the crewmen in command of the lifeboats feared the suction of Titanic as she went under the water. They, being seafaring men, believed that the suction of that great vessel would pull anything and everything down with it. The account was that there was practically no suction at all, barely a ripple. She glided underneath the water. Even people floating near the vessel were not even drawn downward. It was only then that those in charge of lifeboats realized we could have gone back. We could have gone back. What will you do tomorrow to rescue the perishing? Oh, you say, preacher, it's not that immediate. That's probably what they said when the Titanic hit the iceberg. Walk the decks of Titanic at 11 o'clock. Walk the decks of Titanic at 11:15. Stop the passengers and ask them, what do you think of the idea that in 3 hours 1,500 of us will be dead? You'll find how many didn't believe it, but they perished anyway. There's a world out there that may laugh at you. They may ridicule you. They may turn and run from the lifeboat. But thank God if we can get one. If we can find one who says, I'll get in. We can find one who says, I'll believe. If we can find one who says, I'll put my faith in the lifeboat, small in comparison to the giant ship. Insignificant. You'd have looked at lifeboat and Titanic on the water surface. You'd have said how insignificant the little lifeboat was. But the little lifeboat saved lives. And the Titanic took them. The passage said they knew not till the flood came and took them all away. I wonder how many folks will be in hell next week because we do nothing.